Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Nars. I'm your host, David Price. Thank you for joining me today. You are going to hear from Steve. He's going to give you a quick recap, a debriefing of sorts about Baltimore Comic Con. And there's also a little bit of talk about the Mark Waid written S.H.I.E.L.D. series and some 5th anniversary one-shots, and then Kevin, Andrew, and Steve are going to continue their Thunderbolts coverage. I am caught up on a couple things, one in particular, Where Monsters Dwell, read issues 3 and 4, and I don't want to root for Kaufman. I don't think I am. Basically, everything that happens is, these are the consequences of his actions, and I have no problem with anybody getting their comeuppance in that regard. However, I think there's something going on, and I kind of want to root for him as this series wraps up. I will be reading Future Imperfect. That is next on the list. I know that there are a couple things that that I have fallen away from, including Guardians of Nowhere and 1872 and the Siege, which I think I mentioned before, so I have to get back to a few of those things. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. returned. It was a fantastic first episode of the third season. The team is basically what it is. There are actors who are still listed in the credits, two of which we did not see at all in this first episode. The third, wasn't sure if we were going to see, did make an appearance at the end, and man, it's really just, I feel for the dude, and it's been such a joy to watch Ian just go from who Fitz was in the series, in the start of the series, and then last season where he was struggling so much, and now this season starting off, and he is just heartbroken and a bit relentless. So I am really anxious to see where they're taking it and where we go with the whole Inhumans thing, which is kind of, well, for me anyway, it's more of a background thing. That's not the primary focus, which I'm absolutely fine with. So I really did enjoy this first episode. Looking forward to it. Next week is next weekend is New York Comic Con. If you are going, please don't be shy. Don't hesitate to say hello to me, to Vince, to Jason. We will all be there. Roland, our buddy from Australia, will be there with us. So again, I'm going to cut this short because it's getting later than I wanted it, and I still haven't eaten dinner. So I'm going to let the guys do their thing. They're going to finish up. And I will talk to you all soon. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Hey, Howlers. Steve Raker here from the Comic Book Bunker, back from an awesome time at the Baltimore Comic Con.
There's a man who leads a life of danger.
More on the con in the second part of this segment, but first I wanted to give you all a heads up on the latest S.H.I.E.L.D. series, which is now 10 issues old already. If you're like me, and not many are, you might have passed over or picked up this book. I mean, heck, Mark Waid's writing it, right? You might have bought the book but let it fester at the bottom of your to-read pile, or otherwise not get to it quickly enough or have perused it. Well, I'm here to be a little bit of a catalyst. Overall, I'm not the biggest fan of the Hollywoodization of the comics universe that we grew up with. And honestly, I've fallen behind on the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. television show. I'm still in the middle of season two when they're racing to reach the Hidden City. Haven't quite gotten there yet. So I wasn't all that thrilled to see in the solicitations that there was going to be a S.H.I.E.L.D. title that seemed like it might be the comic book exploits of the TV show cast. Although, sure, I can understand it and saw it coming, right? But fortunately, this book achieves all that and handles it in a way that's pretty entertaining to a regular Marvel Universe reader. I mean, heck, Mark Waid's writing it, right? But going in, as usual, I'm not intending to spoil the stories or the story beats, but more looking to share what the contents are, what the variables are at play, who the characters are that are involved in the creative teams. We especially do that when we're talking about recent comics like this, so that you, our dear listeners, can determine if the book is for you. Or, in this case, which issues might be for you. It's that kind of series. So here's the lowdown on this past year's S.H.I.E.L.D. ongoing series and the 50th anniversary one-shots that just occurred over the summer months here. As I said, S.H.I.E.L.D. is written by Mark Waid, and the first issue is drawn by Carlos Pacheco, or Pacheco. And this puts Phil Coulson's team right in the smack middle of the Marvel Universe. Coulson identifies his strength as just knowledge of the Marvel Universe, much as a longtime reader would have, and that he can pick the right agents and superpowered support for the right mission, picking the right bullet to be fired, so to speak. Here he's stopping a big invasion and having to rescue Heimdall, and it has Asgardian implications and stuff. Interesting, and, has the budget that the TV show doesn't, right? So it can deal with some of the things that you wish that the television show could do on its Villain of the Week type episodes. The second issue is also written by Waid. They all are, so I'll stop saying that. And the second issue is drawn by Umberto Ramos and Victor Olazaba. And this has Coulson and Gemma Simmons undercover in a high school to stop this supervillain equipment peddling ring. And it so happens that Ms. Marvel is in this school, the new Ms. Marvel. And they end up fighting off powered gauntlets and Arnim Zola's Doughboys and things like that. The third issue is drawn by Alan Davis and Mark Farmer. I'm going to say that again because that bears repeating. The third issue is drawn by Alan Davis and Mark Farmer. Go pick this one up. Coulson recruits Spider-Man to help stop a robbery in progress. And the robbery is at Doctor Strange's Sanctum Sanctorium. There's nothing like a run through the maze that is Doctor Strange's mansion, especially when he's not home. You never know what's going to be behind door number two. The fourth issue is drawn by Chris Sprouse with inks by Carl Story. And here, Mark Waid reminds us that he totally knows how to write FF characters, opening the book with a scene with Sue and Johnny just relating to each other. And for this fourth issue, Coulson recruits the Invisible Woman to extract a Hydra prisoner from an impossible cell without her being seen. Oh, and she has to perform remote open-heart surgery with invisible surgical tools that she creates from her own mind design in order to defuse a bomb. It's all very tense. The fifth issue bears art from Mike Choi and has Coulson and companies, his team from the show, with the Scarlet Witch to hunt a shooter who's firing these magic bullets. And he's taking down mages like Hellstorm and Wiccan, Satana, Shaman, and Jennifer Kale. And see, all along there's been a developing subplot where they've been investigating Miztek, which is this arms supplier that combines magic and tech. Well, in issue 6, which has wonderful art from Paul Renaud, issue 6 wraps up the whole first arc, revealing the mystical big bad to be. I won't spoil it. I will say, however, that the plot to take out Earth's mages is sinister, to say the least. And that's not a clue. With intelligent beings being targeted during the final assault on the Earth, Coulson calls in support from less cerebrally based individuals. They're Howling Commandos, Simon Garth the Zombie, Man-Thing the Living Mummy, Frankenstein's Monster, and they all have to hold the line. And I know Man-Thing and the Living Mummy aren't the same creature. Issue 7 has art from Greg Smallwood and has Coulson and team and Daisy Quake Johnson taking down Mr. Hyde and appealing to his scientist and father roles in an issue that carefully blends the television Mr. Hyde with the comic one, and I think manages to do a decent job. Wade very carefully walks the line. The 8th issue is drawn by Paco Medina and Juan Velasco, and has Coulson, Melinda May, and Mockingbird investigating, infiltrating, and taking down a slavery, freak show, non-compliant surgical ring. Ugh, less said the better, but there's nice art from Medina and Velasco. Issue 9 is an extra-sized 50th anniversary of S.H.I.E.L.D. issue, with art by Lee Ferguson, at least to the main story. There's also an Art Adams Howling Commandos variant cover. Oof. And the monsters, Howling Commandos I'm talking about, not the World War II ones. Well, in this story of issue 9, there's a clever angle for it to be the anniversary one. The creative team here takes the initial unused two-page visual pitch that Kirby used for the original Kirby Lee Kirby S.H.I.E.L.D. series in Tales of Suspense, which was later given to Jim Steranko as an inking tryout. And they create a whole story around it in the present day that links it to the past and to an adventure that Fury had. It ties the old S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff with the new Coulson multimedia-inspired version, and even uses the Hickman material as a bridge, the old Hickman S.H.I.E.L.D. ancient stuff. I kid you not. You know, heard too that Hickman and Dustin Weaver second volume of that S.H.I.E.L.D. series is going to finish next year finally, after the Secret Wars. How cool is that? So yeah, Coulson, Fury, Leonardo da Vinci, it's all in there. There's also in issue 9 a 20-page backup written by Al Ewing with art by Stefano Caselli that introduces, or reintroduces, I should say, the new horror-oriented Howling Commandos, which are reluctantly led by old Howler Dum Dum Dugan, who's now a horror show all his own. They also reprint the first S.H.I.E.L.D. stories back from Tales of Suspense. Issue 10 is drawn by Evan Shanner, and it has Fitz and this owl-headed agent, less said the better. They are teaming up with Howard the Duck for a trip to Duck World. And did I mention how good issue 9 was? Issue 9 was really good. All right, there's also, that's as far as the series has gotten, and I think they're going to start off with a probably new numbering and a new number one after the Secret Wars, if I'm not mistaken, but maybe they'll continue going as is. There were also 5 50th anniversary special one-shots that occurred over the summer, all from lesser-known creative teams for the most part, and many times seemingly out of continuity, at least to this old war horse. The first, which was right in current continuity, was A Mockingbird, and that was written by Chelsea Kane with art by Joelle Jones, and has the post-Hawkeye, post-Secret Invasion, post-Avengers Mockingbird kind of finding her place and trying to feel something, I guess. The second was written, features Quake, Daisy Johnson, more along the lines of the comic book one, not the television one, written by Rosenberg and Kindlin, with art by Daniel Johnson. I'm not sure if it's in continuity. It's like Daisy's an Avenger, but it's like the pre-Secret Wars Avengers, and that's weird. Another is an Agent Carter one-shot by Catherine Immonen and Rich Ellis, where Peggy teams up with both Dum-Dum and then Sif of Asgard in a period piece from the 60s, because Nick is like in his shield garb and stuff, that kind of couldn't have happened in continuity because we knew Peggy wandered off and then she was found and then she was living in around the Mason-Dixon line there and in the Carolinas or something in the estate, and she didn't join S.H.I.E.L.D. until later, and so I don't get how what they're doing with the revisioning of Agent Carter, but there it is. There's also a Nick Fury one-shot. Well, Marcus Johnson, Nick Fury Jr. 2. Not the one with the long hair, ponytail, and the headband who was white and also lost an eye from the 90s. This is the black one who looks like Samuel Jackson from the Ultimate Universe and who also lost an eye and was also Nick Fury Jr. Written by David Walker with art by Lee Ferguson, who also drew that issue 9 of the main S.H.I.E.L.D. series. We get Fury Jr. going back in time to the 60s, meeting Fury Sr. in the 60s, having an adventure, and turns out he actually likes the guy. Then the most recent one was The Calvary, written by Jody Hauser with art by Luke Ross. This has Melinda May helping a bunch of S.H.I.E.L.D. cadets escape the attack of wild robot dogs. Despite the nice covers, Mike Diodato, Paul Renaud, Dale Keown, you can skip these. All 5 of them. All right, on that note, all right, here we go. The 16th annual Baltimore Comic Con was held September 25th through 27th at the Baltimore Convention Center, which is conveniently located blocks from the Inner Harbor tourist trap zone that's full of restaurants, themed bars, museums, an aquarium. You got it. I was invited down to check it out, speak with creators, and gather material for use during future podcasts. You know, I'm always mentioning the Baltimore Comic Con over the course of the year of podcasting as I'm talking about meeting up with creators when appropriate, and I get to report to you all on the experience. The Baltimore Comic Con again this year was 3 days, with a preview type day on Friday from 1 to 7 p.m. and then the regular type con hours from, you know, 10 a.m. on Saturday and Sunday. Now, the con promoters really put some logical thought into the content and layout of the show. You don't find yourself totally scratching your head saying, what were they thinking? The con floor was totally set up to exploit the space and to break up the crowd, which it did quite effectively, even if it made me walk more from to get to one thing to the other. And it broke up the crowd nicely even during the busiest hours on Saturday, which was the peak day of the show. The con staff, too, was a presence in numbers. There was always a minion's ear to bend when needed or to get direction from. There was this near center area of the con floor that was sectioned off with tables and chairs that was dedicated to kids programming, which seemingly ran around the clock and was really well attended. The kids programming area was surrounded by a kids zone of creators booths that displayed all ages type work, you know, really to be appreciated and to catch the eye of the right audience there. And along the left wall was an ample section with lanes for, like, celebrity autographs, and upstairs were multiple rooms for panels and stuff, so it really split up all those crowds quite nicely. In the center of the con floor space, as you first walk into the con, was the retail zone, with vendor booths set up selling toys, apparel, comics, books, trinkets, other kinds of collectibles. When you walked into the con, you walked right into that center aisle of the retail zone. And if you walk deeper down that center aisle, you come upon the kids' zone, and beyond that, the artist's alley aisles. And way along the very back wall behind the artist's alley were a few tables set up to accommodate creators with the, you know, who are likely going to have the largest lines, like David Finch and Scott Snyder, Ethan Van Sciver, Jim Starlin. The other too big for artist's alley type creators were set up along the right and left sides of the retail space in 3 or 4 aisles on either side, blending with the kids' zone. And this kept the traffic moving like along the periphery for visits with creators or for food or the bathrooms, which were along the outside walls, and more of the shopping melee in the center. The guest list of creators was nothing short of fantastic, as I've been saying for months, including my two favorite living artists, Bernie Wrightson and Jim Starlin. The longest lines in the main aisles were for Amanda Connor and Jimmy Palmiotti, for Darwin Cook, and at times for Mark Wade, and the Simonsons. Creators were, for the most part, you know, on. They were, by and large, quite friendly and in their fan-greeting personas. Darwin Cook was a little bit detached, kind of didn't even look up when I spoke briefly with him, but he had quite a grind with a long line all weekend. Over the course of the weekend, I had the pleasure of meeting or speaking to the likes of, in alphabetical order, Neil Adams, Jeremy Bastian, Bob Budiansky, Sean Chen, Frank Cho, Ramona Fraiden, Mike Grell, Russ Heath, Clayton Henry, Jeff Isherwood, J.G. Jones, Tom King, of course, Dennis Kitchen, Barry Kitson, Mike Lilly, Mike Manley, Ron Mars, Bob McLeod, Tom Palmer, Dan Parent, Andrew Peepoy, Bart Sears, Walt Simonson, Andy Smith, Jim Starlin, Eric Talbot, Tim Truman, Billy Tucci, Charles Vess, Mark Wade, Marv Wolfman, Bernie Wrightson, and Mike Zach. There were several others I'd have also spoken with, but I'd either have just spoken with them recently, or their lines were too long, or the stars were somehow otherwise misaligned. But a great guest list, right? I drove down to Baltimore from upstate New York. About a six-hour drive or so, broken up halfway for me on Thursday in New Jersey, where I picked up Alan, our new mutant, and Daryl of the Taylor Network and No Apologies and Comic Book Roadshow and DC Noise podcasts. By meeting in Jersey, we escaped the traffic related to a papal visit in New York City that same day and ended up arriving in Baltimore in the later afternoon, hitting up our favorite across-the-street pub from the con, the Pratt Street Ale House, for some grub and drink before checking into the hotel and watching the Giants game that night against the Redskins, so it was also so somewhat local. Our hotel was connected to the convention center via an enclosed glass elevated walkway, which makes the whole weekend quite convenient for running back up to the room for whatever reason. I recommend highly connecting yourself to the convention with your hotel wherever you can, so that you can drop stuff off or use the bathroom if you need to or whatever. Friday, we picked up our press badges and met up with others in our group of friends, like Hassan and Billy Z. The night before, we'd already rendezvoused with Mike and Barb Myers. Mike's also from the DC Noise podcast, and we weren't letting them out of our sight the whole weekend. We also crossed paths with Rock and his family, who were splitting time between family activities in the tourist trap zone and cruising the con floor. Friday was the preview day, but within the first half hour or so of the show, it seemed that many creators I was soliciting for artwork had their lists full, or were suggesting, you know, checking back Sunday. With the smaller crowd on Friday, I had either all of my sketches done or set up that day. Saturday was so busy that whatever wasn't finished Friday wasn't done until Sunday, so good thing I got on a few choice lists. More on that in a minute. Friday night, we've connected with our good pal Tom King, who he's had a heck of a year writing Grayson and Omega Men for the Distinguished Competition, and whose Vision book for Marvel hits shelves in a few weeks. And had dinner, and we ended up hanging at the hotel bar among friends like Ron Mars and idols like Jim Starlin. Saturday was a busy day crowd-wise at the con. I kept checking back with artists, like on the status of my sketches, but like I said, I'd end up having to wait until Sunday. That left Saturday to take pictures of the con floor, talk with creators for the show, shop and speak with vendors, and walk the floor with my friends from our podcasting circles. We hung out at Tom King's table a lot, likely much to his chagrin, but afterwards took over like three tables connecting them at a harborside restaurant and had a great dinner, especially since Chris Campbell visited, also of No Apologies and our own Fantastic Foresights bits back in the day. he was almost a new dad then, and totally, most definitely is a new dad now. That's how close it was. So it was really great to have him shoot over and visit for the day and into the night. Saturday night also hosted the Harvey Award ceremonies, and results were distributed and were the topic of some conversation on Sunday at the show. By Sunday, man, we were certainly tired. By the end of three con days, I had walked almost 24 miles. But I still had art to wait for, so I did. In between walking the floor with the guys and hanging out at and around Tom's table. Sunday didn't seem as crowded as I expected it was going to be, which again allowed time to chat with creators and otherwise convene, as we do at conventions. When our art was picked up and we were ready to boogie out of there, Alan and Daryl and I were luckily the beneficiaries of an overtime home Ravens football game, which allowed us to drive right out of town before the crowd hit the parking lots. It was excellent. It was a long drive back home to upstate New York, because I dropped off Alan on the street somewhere in Manhattan after we came out of the Holland Tunnel, and Daryl back home in Queens before I shot back up north to Albany. And I stopped at a rest area on the New York State Thruway at around 10 p.m. to watch the lunar eclipse, which was cool, and made it home just before my arbitrary deadline of midnight. All right, now the best part, my loot from the con. You can see pics of most of these pieces on the Marvel Noise Facebook page or the 11 o'clock comics Facebook page, or look for a Twitter link from @MarvelNoise. I picked up a few books from the Heroes Initiative booth, as well as, at least initially, an exclusive Walter Simonson Ragnarok Artist Editions portfolio from him and had him sign it for me. Ramona Fraden brought dozens of 5x5.5-inch sketches with her, and I couldn't help but pick up an Adam Strange plate. By midday Saturday, she was almost cleaned out and was apologizing to people for not having brought more. She's so awesome. Just turned 89, too. On my Marvel Villains Jam piece, I was able to have Andy Smith draw a noble-looking Loki, as well as Mike Lilly crafting an awesomely cosmic Galactus with his hand in front and depth, and he built up the white out on his nose so it the highlight, like, makes it come out in 3D. Really cool effect. My Thor jam was graced by a Clayton Henry Thor center square and a Tim Truden Odin. Jim Starlin doesn't do sketches at cons anymore, but brings a collection of pieces with him, including a Dreadstar full figure that I am now able to call my own. I bought a bunch of prints from Bernie Wrightson all weekend long, just to have another chance to speak with him and let him know how much I appreciated his presence there. Archie Comics extraordinaire artist Dan Parent drew a colorful Betty and Veronica as Black Canary and Wonder Woman piece for me, and I couldn't help but ask Andrew Peepoy to draw the Invisible Woman in his Good Girl style. I bought a page of art from a recent Tarzan tale in Dark Horse Presents from one of my favorites of all time, Mike Gorell. I also picked up a wonderful Conan profile from Jeff Isherwood, and lastly was able to have the honor of having Bob Budiansky draw a maniacal Ghost Rider for me. How's that for some scores? Check him out on our Facebook page. Next year's Baltimore Comic Con will be Labor Day weekend, September 2nd to 4th, 2016. So circle your calendars now, boys and girls, because if you didn't attend, you missed a good one this year. You can leave comments for us on our Marvel Noise Facebook page or on Twitter @MarvelNoise or @SteveRaker. There's also usually an episode thread on the 11 o'clock comics forums, although I admit I haven't been visiting there as frequently because I've been having staying signed in and getting signed out issues there. But anyway, coming up on the show in coming episodes, Tomb of Dracula for the holiday, more S.H.I.E.L.D. action with Hickman's Secret Warriors, and our collective cast's continued reactions to all the doings in Secret Wars as it progresses. And more, like for instance, our continuing Thunderbolts coverage, the latest installment of which is up during this episode. Later!
They tried to stop us, but we're back. It's time for Heroes Return Thunderbolts, everybody's most remembered segment. or partially remembered segment. It's our Thunderbolts coverage, and we're back after a brief hiatus and other battle world could only contain us for so long. But it's me, Andrew, the LA Rabbit, calling in from Los Angeles, joined, as always, by the Thunderbolts man himself, Kevin, Whirlwind X up in Canada.
All right.
And, of course, our guru of everything comic-related, dialing in from the bunker, Super Steve.
Hi-ho!
And here we are, folks. For those of you that can't remember, oh so long ago, we started our coverage with issue one of Thunderbolts from 1990, late 90s. And we are now up to issue number 60.
2002. I can't believe it's 2002.
Wow. It seems like eons. Well, we covered some other issues and related stuff along the way. So it probably has been eons.
We've certainly seen a lot come and go. And as our tradition continues, Kevin, do you want to give us a rundown of the Thunderbolts lineup?
Sure. And you can also find all Thunderbolts goodness with images and related at the Thunderbolts Tumblr. Thunderbolts.tumblr.com. Why do I always mess that up?
Because we batted around like four different iterations of the Thunderbolts Tumblr mashup. Which one did we decide on?
Wasn't it the Thumbler Bolts?
There you go.
Yeah, thunderbolts.tumblr.com.
No, you post good stuff on there.
I try to. The Thunderbolts lineup. Current lineup. Baron Zemo is Citizen V. Or is he? He's a swordsman. Master planner, not blaster. He was using Citizen V's body. Carla is Moonstone, using a gem, but isn't gem. Seemingly always wobbling back and forth on her road to redemption. Melissa is Songbird, evolving sonic powers that she uses with improving tech. Eric and Dallas. Dallas was once Citizen V. Eric was Atlas. Now they sort of use the same red bubblegum ionic form body that's kind of confusing and weird. Abe is Mach 3. His flying suit does whatever he wants. Just about. Norbert, the fixer. He's a tech man with a tech backpack with a little surprise in it. And Haley, Jolt. Electric powers and back from the dead again. And our ex-Thunderbolts, or Thunderbolt. Clint, Hawkeye, ex-Avenger. He's on the run from the law, and he needs to find a bow and arrow since, you know, that's really his thing.
Thank you, Kevin. And to refresh everyone's recollection, the Thunderbolts had done the big knockdown drag out with a Graviton. And seemingly, they were all killed except for Melissa, who stayed in the... But really, they woke up in this strange world. And Melissa is still screaming Mimi's back in the regular world. Or I guess she goes by Songbird now. So our erstwhile heroes wake up to Baron Heinrich Zemo pointing a gun at them. And they got to think fast on their feet. And we're back with our solid creative team that we've been going for a while. And that's the Nisienza, Zercher, and Vey. And I got to say, they're really finding their groove from an art perspective on this one.
Yep.
And as a little refresher, Thunderbolts was Kevin's jam. He got me to read it. Steve was on again, off again. These are all new to me. And if I'm not mistaken, starting now, these are all new again to Steve for a while.
Yes. I stopped reading Last Ish.
I don't know why.
I don't want to read another alternate universe thing.
This is true, but this is good stuff. And it's not so all alternate.
Yeah, so they wake up, and it's not a good-looking universe. There's all these kind of errats of Thunderbolts kind of pointing weapons at them, including Zemo. And they got to think fast on their feet. And you know who's going to talk their way out of this?
The Fixer?
No, Moonstone.
Oh, hey, you know that Hawkeye and Moonstone are still in that circle on the cover.
Yep, the dynamic duo.
Which also has our new Thunderbolts from this mysterious world that's giving trouble to our Thunderbolts.
These are the German Thunderbolts.
It's like a super team, and they give their own rundown.
Oh, do I get to do another rundown?
They're international heroes of Germany of Earth. Phantom Eagle, powered by a mysterious gem. The mutant known as Solar, the copyright infringement.
the armored Iron Cross, who we had in our universe, big guy in a suit, Chain Lightning, the heroine of France, bubblegum character, and the American engineering wizard known as Makeshift, who's like a lady fixer.
You know, the other thing weird is they have a Disney ad in here for a TV show called Timo Supremo, and one of them has a Thunderbolts insignia on their belt, and their costume's red and blue.
I think you might be reading into some of this a little. You might have gone too deep down the rabbit hole. So Moonstone talks their way out of this, saying, "You know, we were just here. We were hired to check up on you guys. We're not here to fight you guys." You know, Zemo's like, "Well, all right, I'm going to let you live." So they book out of there and try and place where they're at. And as in typical Thunderbolt style, everybody's still getting a little bit of time. So we have to spend some time with the, what are we going to call the Atlas Reardon V bubblegum creature?
Do they not have a name? That's like so weird that, bubblegum?
So bubblegum, we spent some time in bubblegum's head because it's kind of interesting. They're, now that Jerry's not here, I can use DC references. Sort of like a Firestorm vibe, almost.
I'm not familiar with that character.
How about Captain Marvel from the 70s?
That works.
There you go. Except neither one of them is big into CB. And as they fly away, we have a mysterious little zoom-in on the Fixer's backpack.
Isn't that hilarious?
Sure, that was just a completely random panel placement.
Yeah, and it's just a weird squiggly that just happens to resemble someone's mask.
But who is back again, Kevin?
Citizen V.
In the real world. Citizen V is back and better than ever.
And where is he? He's in Simcaria, who we know about from last episode's Silver Sable bit.
This syncs up pretty well. Wow. Sounds planning.
And next time, and they figure this time, he isn't being controlled by Velma.
Yeah. Hopefully, but...
this time.
Yeah, those corrupted overlapping electroencephalograms have been wiped from Watkins's brain, and now Citizen V is Citizen V again, and Helmet is out of there. Helmet is out of his helmet.
But how much does Baron Zemo remember? Like, he saw a lot of going on. I don't know, the V Battalion's a little concerned.
I'm also concerned about how much John remembers. You know, but he has a new costume design.
Well, he doesn't want to wear the purple anymore.
No. Yeah. And they have a nice little footnoted heavy promotion for his upcoming limited series, which we may or may not.
Right after they send him on a mission. You want to go on a mission? Sure. See the new Citizen V limited series, which we'll cover next episode.
And it's outside of Pittsburgh. I don't know. Hawkeye seems to be on this new reality TV show where, like, they're made up to look like criminals and like they have these shackles and everything and they have to stay in close proximity. It could have been a reality show, really. Like they had that one where guys were sitting in the chair and they were throwing knives at you or something. You had to keep your heart rate down. Like there was a lot of weird reality shows.
These guys, that or a sitcom. I mean, the four of them on the run. Again, like you say, stuck in close proximity to each other because of their manacles and not able to use their powers. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's like a buddy road trip. You have Cottonmouth, who's the, you know, street level, not very smart, kind of savage killer. Plant Man, the sort of hippie, let's knock off Jason Woodrue from DC. Hawkeye, our double agent, bad guy pretending to be a good guy. And then a generic villain no one's ever heard of, just so Mentallo can take him over.
Headlock.
Yeah, I'm not bothering to remember his name. But the problem is the Guardsman shows up. I always liked the Guardsman uniform. Yeah. I thought they did a good enough job distinguishing it from Iron Man, even though it's sort of based on that. Although I would have preferred a Mandroid, to be honest with you.
Mandroids, don't you have to cart those in like on trucks or something because they're really heavy duty?
Well, they used to have different ones, you remember? They would have specialized mandroids for different capabilities.
Yeah, I think the mold spores, it'd be harder to get inside a mandroid armor with those, but Plant Man manages to get them into this dude. Yeah. Fatal outcome, too.
But we then flash over to our other, the real Thunderbolt team, who are all dressed up like Ruskies with the big fur hats.
And it looks like computer-generated dollar bills are going past them. Or some kind of weird computer effect.
I think they're supposed to be rubles or something. But yeah, the money is... I thought they looked almost Doom Patrol-ish with the Dallas in the wheelchair and techno, kind of looking all techno-y.
So first he was being Oracle, and now she's being the guy from Doom Patrol?
Yeah. This is my episode to work in every DC reference I can think of.
Hello, DC Noise.
Yeah, go work for DC. Is this, you know, you're going to send this episode off to try to get on DC Noise now?
This is my application reel.
Oh, I see.
I just have to keep favorably comparing, except they don't recognize any Marvel references, so I'm there to bridge the gap. This works the side stories of, like, Techno doesn't really care. Moonstone's looking out for herself. Haley's kind of the one that's most concerned about it. But Dallas is a bit freaked out. Abe is super wishy-washy and just wants to get back to Melissa. So all these things are sort of conflating what they're going to do. Generally, they're keeping a low profile.
Well, yeah, look at the world they're in. Like, just horrible things are going on everywhere they step, so...
So the Fixer's working on a translator, and he finally gets it to work just as some mob violence breaks out. And Haley, bubblegums out and goes to stop it. And Norbert makes a few jokes about communism not working out. And then Haley figures out where they are.
Oh, you know where they are?
I know. It's something that should have been in Battle World is where they are.
They're gone Counter-Earth.
Exactly.
Which iteration of Counter-Earth? Earth, I'm not entirely sure, but
yeah, this is the second Counter-Earth, right? The one that's really the Heroes Reborn world, where it was brought into our world as the new Counter-Earth.
Yeah, and Doom sort of had his way with the world, or you know, tried to I guess instill some order and put it back together, but that didn't work out so well. So they've been facing a lot of natural disasters and general chaos and anarchy and everything. And Germany is one of the few countries that's together a little bit.
Really surprised we didn't get a footnote here about their experiences with the Counter-Earth. And like I said, I'm really bummed Counter-Earth never made it to Battleworld. Doom could have relived those glory days.
Yeah, it's funny they with the whole thing that you know, our savior was Doom and everything. I'm like, yeah, Doom was practicing for Secret Wars.
So, as usual, we're prescient in our predictions and reading habits. We're seeing it before. We're through the looking glass, people. But basically, now that they're on that, Germany's doing the first rocket launch in a few years. And Norbert's like, look, all we got to do is sneak on board the ship and then jam it. And then once we're on the rocket, it'll catch up. We just got to float, and Earth, the real Earth, will catch up, and we can play Xbox on my tech pack and hang out for 6 months. It'll be great. And I'm thinking, I wonder if Marvel had a deal with X. Like, did they not go PlayStation there? Did they go Xbox?
Yeah, whatever fits in the word balloon better.
But I mean, there's kind of torn on it. But you know that Mach wants to get back to Melissa.
Yeah, he doesn't really care about too much. He's just like, this is get home. I gave up this hero stuff. I was done. I was out. You're not dragging me back in.
And but we have a surprise, as Techno's the last one, because suddenly Arnim Zola pops out of his chest.
Whoa, you don't want that situation going on. No, it's actually Baron Zemo.
It looks like Cameron Hodge from the X-Men Executioner song.
That too. Well,
I guess I thought more Zemo, or more Arnim Zola with that weird kind of triangular face.
Yeah, you don't want that coming out of your stomach, that's for sure.
It's the first
of a different kind.
It's the first Spider Slayer. Jameson's face on it.
So somehow, Zemo, you can't keep a bad man down. That guy is going everywhere. And that's how 60 ends.
Yeah, he comes mechanically out of the gut of Techno. Crazy.
Yeah, and the next issue promises Thunderbolts versus Thunderbolts. The Chain Gang fights back. What's up with Songbird? And who will serve as Zemo's new body? Uh-oh.
We open right up with the Zercher and Scott Koblish cover.
Yeah, this is a pretty good cover.
Which is cool, and it's Hawkeye standing over the guardsman, as Steve intimated. Sadly, the spores. reacted poorly with him because he had asthma.
Yeah, this is. I kind of wondered for a second, did they allow, or was he hiding his asthma so he could be a guardsman?
Yeah, well, they could probably just put an inhaler built into the guardsman suit.
Yeah.
That's a lot of spores, guys. It's like coming out of his nose and eyes, and that's more than just he has a little asthma. I mean, that...
Steve, it was an accident.
It's coming out of his ears. It's like filled his whole skull cavity.
Well, maybe he had more face, but the credits are interesting because they go with Boss, Big Boss, and Baddest Boss. Bill Jemis, who's still kicking around comics today.
Is he?
Yeah, I just saw some news article that his some kind of Night of the Living Dead comics are getting pulled from Hot Topic for inappropriate content.
So here's the problem, though. If the Plant Man killed this guardsman guy, Hawkeye's with them. And you know, he wanted to get rid of the guardsman and so they could get away from him, not be apprehended. But not like this.
He wanted to get the Justin Hammer goods so he could work from the inside. And flashback to Dum-Dum, who gets an anonymous tip on the dead guardsman. And now they can't track him anymore because Plant Man took the guardsman's armor and used it to jam it. So they're stuck.
So how hard was it for Hawkeye to find a phone, not have the other guys notice, and... like, do this anonymous tip.
Bathroom break.
Apparently. And then we find out what Melissa has been up to, too. She's then, sort of hanging out with fake... I guess I don't acknowledge the fake Dugan, you know,
thing. Yeah, so. I don't. That's real dumb.
So that guy's definitely dumb right there. So, yeah, Melissa's hanging out with Dum-Dum, and, you know, she's going to help S.H.I.E.L.D. and everything.
Yeah, because she had been working with them in the Silent issue that we had seen prior to this, so it makes sense why she's there. And she's kind of curious about, you know, what's going on with Clint, how is this going to play out. But meanwhile, we transition to Counter-Earth, which is real post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, we learn about what a hellhole it is.
The train that the Thunderbolts were on got derailed, and there's looting over water supplies. And again, we have... all the Thunderbolts are reacting differently. And they make a point to notice that the letterers got tired of doing Haley's messed up speech. So she's rehabbing.
I guess so.
And, you know, Moonstone points that out. Hey, your speech is getting better. I.e. the letterers are tired of translating your speak into Haley speak. And when they just talk about what a pit Counter-Earth is and how it's gone bad, but...
yeah, it's all planet, you know, everyone's on their spectrum.
Where's Galactus when you need him?
Oh, I think they did that story already with the High Evolutionary.
I know. That was one of my first FF comics off the rack.
But yeah, New York is all Planet of the Apes. And then we have... I was looking at all the Hulks that are rampaging. This sounds like another story. Like Fall of the Hulks.
Yeah, how about that? A gamma radiated desert filled with Hulks. I don't know where that's from.
Yeah, and then Paris is just fused glass.
Mm. It's lovely this time of year.
Oh, and then you have a proposal for a Japanese manga here with earthquakes rock Tokyo every few days. So while these kids are going into a tunnel in their train, something happens to their train, and they're stuck underground, and some of them start going crazy, and then after a few volumes, they get out and see what actually happened to Tokyo, and all this weird stuff is... anyways.
By a few, I'm sure you mean several hundred.
No, three volumes. Four volumes. It was only a 10-volume series.
So everybody's kind of, as we said, we're all split out. Abe really just wants to get home. Haley wants to do something. Moonstone's trying to keep to herself. But the one with the most problems is the Fixer. Because Zemo points out that as long as he's got that broken neck and he's in his tech pack... he can cause him pain and kill him.
Yeah, the Zemo was being particularly nasty here, like making him hit himself and all this type of stuff. It's like, whoa, these guys used to be friends and now they're... well, I guess Zemo sort of... he has a trouble figuring out where Fixer ends and Techno begins and that whole stuff, so he's kind of raw with that whole deal too, and all the Scourge and all that type of stuff.
Why are you hitting yourself?
Yeah, exactly.
They do a nice couple of pages recap, as Kevin intimated. There was a whole section where a robot version of Fixer did a bunch of nice things, and it was a clever way to sort of walk it back and have him get his real body back and not be part of the same entity that did that. And
but the bottom line is that Zemo wants the Fixer to find him a body to house his consciousness.
You know, guys, yes. Biomodems, if you ever can buy biomodems on bulk, they come in real handy with body transference and everything. Just make a note of that.
Yep.
And then we cut over to the heroes of Germany, international heroes of the world, and they're working on the rocket. But the Moonstone guy.
Phantom Eagle.
I like him. Because he's kind of just big and dumb and looks like a man, Moonstone. But there's some intertensions with them. But basically, the whole point is, this really isn't a humanitarian rocket. It's a rocket for Germany to send up to take control of the world.
Ah, Germany.
Zemo.
And we're going to get some not subtle allusions to other German efforts.
Yeah.
But Iron Cross, he doesn't like how... He's the one that follows orders. The rest of them are kind of chatty, and he's like, hey, don't do anything to screw this up. We're on point. That's when the Thunderbolts, we flashback, realize that the problem with all this is why the train was attacked was for water resources.
But really, if they build this filtration system for these people for water, like, they have to do this, if they're going to save this world, like, they're going to have to do this thousands of times over. And this is only for the water. Like, this world is really messed up, so...
Save the world? Can't we just go home?
Yeah. Like, it would be easier for them to just go home instead of, like, rule or, you know, try to fix this messed up world. Like, that seems like what you would do to, like, another universe of characters, or you would put some characters over on another world somewhere and then have them... do some
Kevin, we can't take everybody's problems and make them our own. We can't help everyone in our own world, let alone in this other world.
But wouldn't this be a way that Thunderbolts could redeem themselves on another world?
Kevin, you're talking about the Redeemers. They got done in by Graviton.
Well, Joel's here. Maybe Charcoal.
Yeah, if he gets his act together, literally, in this case. But they're pushing on to their rocket. Haley's feeling good. Mach 3 helps a woman bury her husband, which was a nice moment. I didn't need the broken English of them thanking him afterwards. Could have done without that. But it is a nice moment.
I like thinking that the two panels where they show the attachment of the piping that allows for the running water, I like to think that those two panels are like 1 second after each other. So that you're looking over Jolt's face and the tube is in place and the water's rushing through and, you know, it's totally encompassed and knocked over the Roydian, you know, pink bubblegum character.
I like how it's the new bubblegum superhero.
I don't know what to call it either. It's the weirdest thing. It's talking like Eric, but it's got boobs.
Yeah, well, when they're in, I don't even know what to say. When they're in human form, Dallas is in control.
Okay.
But Eric speaks when they're in bubblegum form. But they think as one.
Female.
Eric's, that's always the sad sack. Like, she's, like, evening him out and everything. So, with their thought processes, he's less sad sacky and not making mistakes as often.
At least we don't have to hear them thinking about each other, because now they are one.
Well, as Wanda told us, you have to love them a lot or it's not going to work. We'll see if they make out. But meanwhile, Zemo and the Fixer have like this odd couple relationship going on where they're always joking on each other. And Zemo's found a body.
Whoa.
He holds up a picture of the other Zemo.
Oh, yeah, the other Zemo, of course.
Or Phantom Eagle.
The man Moonstone. and Iron Cross, all three of them.
Yeah, but they're just behind Zemo. Of course, he wants Zemo's body.
I think he wants Man Moonstone so he can make out with Moonstone in some weird dual nature thing. But then our last epilogue has all our escapees camping out by a fire.
Smithers, sort of... what is it?
Hey, Cottonmouth is so creepy, too. He's just like, well, we have these manacles on our arms, so you know if I chew off our arms, we can just leave our manacles behind, but we won't have hands anymore, but anyhow, we'll worry about that later.
It's even worse. What he was going to do is gnaw off their arms and take all their arms with him.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, what the?
That's awful.
Well, at least they'd be able to split up. And then they don't know what to do with...
They'd be split up all right.
With him. And then our final page is Mimi's in action. Wearing a dreadful choice of clothing.
Well, she's trying to
just
get...
Just when I thought I was out of the 90s.
Well, she's trying to get back into the...
gloves and the leather jacket come back.
The Mimi groove, you know, the supervillain headspace and everything. But I have to ask you guys, did you look at the hotel registry?
No.
I want you to read the hotel registry to me. Who's at this place?
Jen?
Yes.
Whirlwind? Nice. Silver
That's
Lantern.
Me!
You were there, Kevin.
I'm there! I'm in a comic! How crazy is that?
That's awesome. Well, and I like that she is wearing her Thunderbolts insignia.
Yes.
And a belly button ring. She got her belly button pierced for the occasion.
So remember,
and her hair
like,
braided out.
A few issues ago, there was a rubble somewhere. There was a bunch of names. Those were message board people. And in this hotel registry, more message board people.
Oh, it really, really is you.
Yeah.
It's not just it's the character you happen to go by the name of. That's you because you're a Thunderbolts aficionado.
Well, this Silver Lantern, How would that work in the Marvel Universe anyways? Like, these are people.
Andrew, I bow down to Kevin.
Yeah.
At this point.
You know, all this Thunderbolts podcast has been waiting to this moment where I would say, hey, I'm in this comic.
Now Kevin's going to quit.
It's like, he's like Pat Loika of 2002.
That would be cool if I owned that page too. I'd be like, yes, check that out. And then after the fact, I remember
you know
telling
what, Kevin,
people...
the page isn't lettered, sorry.
Yeah. But they're like, too bad it wasn't your real name. And then after the fact, I'm like, yeah, didn't think that through, did I?
At least you weren't Dusty Donuts.
Yeah, and so that lead... Wow, that is that's something, Kevin. That's something to put on the resume.
Yeah, I'm speechless.
You've been hiding that out. You've been holding your cards for 61 issues.
Oh, I know. When we were getting close to it, I was just like, oh, man, we're almost there. I'm like, and then we stalled, and I'm like, oh, man, I want to tell them about this moment.
Wow. Whenever, yeah, I just thought it was, you know, a reference to Whirlwind, but it's a reference
Our
to Deep.
Very cool.
Well, that leads us to issue 62. And like I said, it's the Hero's Return. We're no longer Marvel's Most Wanted. Nor are we Justice Like Lightning. But it's a pretty cool cover with Techno, and he has a magnifying glass over part of him that reveals Zemo.
Yeah. Is he teched out? Like, I mean, like Cable teched out. Like, when he had those big staple guns and everything, like, just massive backpack.
And you guys get the joke of this Hero's Return bit, too, right? I mean, the Hero's Return moniker banner appeared on... those comics after Heroes Reborn, which was like the late 80s or late 90s, I mean, you know what I mean? After the Image guys did their year.
Yeah.
So that was the Heroes Return. So the Heroes Return wasn't used for a few years here. And because the Thunderbolts are visiting that Heroes Reborn planet, they're getting the Heroes Return thing. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. You got to use that branding over and over again.
Hey, you designed that logo. Although I'll be glad when Justice Like Lightning and Marvel's Most Wanted returns. Kind of like those names.
Well, you get it? The Thunderbolts never had their Heroes Return from the Heroes Reborn universe because they're the ones who picked up... They formed when the Heroes went to the Heroes Reborn world.
Yeah.
Right? So they were already here. They never went away and come back. They never had the Heroes Return thing on their comic, even though everyone else did. Now they do.
And it's the final countdown.
Ground control to me. 10.
So, basically, they have a kooky scheme to get on board the shuttle. And it's Zemo doesn't like this plan.
No, he wants a body. And a body now.
And so he gives a little Zolt. Makes Techno jump a little bit. And then, so the plan is put in motion. And like I said, Zercher and Vey are really doing top-notch work. Moonstone seduces the bozo Moonstone. She's like, I almost feel bad for him, but I don't. And Amok slips in as an engineer, you know. And then Zemo, this is the only part I didn't care for. He's giving the speech, and they superimpose the Hitler behind him. And I'm like, yeah, you can lay off that a little bit. Like, we all get it. We're not dumb.
Yeah, but it's this world Zemo. It's this. It's the old Zemo, the German Thunderbolt Zemo.
Heinrich Zemo. Right.
But I mean,
not Helmut.
It just seemed like a little heavy hand. Now, one thing, if you make it really be like the hate monger takes off his mask and it's Hitler or something, but just to throw the image up there seemed a little, I don't know, not needed.
Yeah, and Bubblegum is talking, even though they don't need to talk since they think together, but they're digging a huge tunnel underneath where the space shuttle is supposed to take off. And then we see a panel where they're back-to-back and naked, too.
Butt-to-butt.
Yeah.
Well, they're also, but they've arched their backs, so they're butt and shoulders together.
Yeah. Yeesh.
But then suddenly they're, I do like how kind of stylish they are in their civilian clothes, though.
Thank God they have clothes on.
But, so Techno's going to do the Zemo plan. So he sneaks in and zaps Makeshift and suggests maybe Zemo wants to take over Makeshift? Because she has certain assets?
Well, you know,
another body might be missing?
I think that's more Fixer's type of thing. Do you remember when he was in his Techno body?
Yes.
So not really Zemo's thing, and he's a little freaked out going, I'm not going to be in a woman's body.
So the Fixer's got to go forward with the plan, so he's got to gas the main crew, which is copyright infringement man, fake Moonstone.
There's Zemo, two R's on that cross. Solar.
Solar, non-man of the non-atom.
Dr. Hafafar.
And then Techno bursts in a full-page splash that is cool and problematic all at the same time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, his boots, I have no idea what's going on there.
It's tech.
And his left arm and hand are completely perplexing. But it looks badass. Look at it for too long.
No. Don't be accused of looking at it for too long either, because his junk is pretty much center stage.
But that left arm, like, what? And the hand, like, I don't even know what, and the boots again, I'm still wondering, like, are they giant? Did he take over the frogman's armor?
He still looks like he's going to kick butt.
Yeah.
And he does.
And there's that mirror, too, that he's holding where Baron Zemo's watching.
And it's bing, bong, zoom. Fixer takes out the Iron Cross.
Yeah, so it looks like he's trying to transfer Zemo's consciousness and everything into this Iron Cross character, and then you're like, oh, I hope Iron Cross is 100 years old, like our, you know.
Yeah, why would he want to be an old man?
Yeah.
Fixer's like, I did my part. I'm getting out of here. Because Makeshift wakes up, and then there's some dude who looks like he's naked on the floor, but I guess that's probably a fake Moonstone.
Yeah.
And he's like, I got to get out of here. You're on your own. And
you got to make the launch. Off.
In the meantime, the Thunderbolts are putting on their outfits, so we get a gratuitous shot of Moonstone zipping up hers.
Hey, if anyone's going to be zipping up, it has to be Carla, right?
Yay.
And they're like, where is that guy? God darn it. And then suddenly, he races after them, and then the fake Thunderbolts are after this world's heroes are after him.
But
of course, take those bozos out in two seconds flat.
Our Thunderbolts are a well-oiled machine by this point. I was just like, yeah, this is going to be easy.
And then Zemo kind of wakes up all groggy with Stan Lee's 9 words of German that everyone needs to know. Boss, 9.
Yeah, but at this point, our Zemo walks in here in his Iron Cross armor, and he doesn't look as old, but he's still kind of in shadow. And in something that's, you're just like, wait, what is going on? And he just murders this Counter-Earth Zemo in brutal fashion.
Wow, Zemo recognizes the Iron Cross as his son, Helmet.
Yeah.
You know, when you look back a couple of issues, when they first were talking to each other, when they in one of the first scenes of these bunch, he actually called him Helmet, and I missed it, so that this scene was still powerful, even though it was given away like 2 issues ago.
But it wasn't, because he could have been Helmet Grueler.
Right.
Not and also Helmet Zemo.
Some way for Helmet, for our Zemo to know that that would be a good body to take over, too.
Yeah.
So he's getting his own body in this other dimension. Sneaky, sneaky.
That is pretty weird, though. And then you getting down, like, not your father, but, like...
Your other dimensional father.
Yeah, like...
Wow.
This is the other levels of psychosis.
Yeah, he's like, here I can build.
Yeah, it makes Zemo seem not like the nicest guy.
Has he ever been the nicest guy? Well, okay, maybe for a moment when he was Citizen V, there was a second there. Maybe.
But yeah, he saved nicest? That kid.
Yeah,
that
but then he was like, ugh, this kid, I gotta save.
And I do like the answer, Helmet, my son. Well, yes and no.
I don't have time to explain it to you while I'm murdering you.
And the rocket takes off, but suddenly the rocket doesn't take off. And it blows up like a big angry, no sound effect.
I know, that's kind of surprising. And you see the young allies are watching on TV there, too, as a cameo.
Oh, yeah. In space, no one can hear you scream.
And
on Counter-Earth.
And then flying out of the explosion is Bubblegum, Fixer, Mach, Moonstone, and Joel.
Yeah.
And Bubblegum's carrying something.
And they introduce themselves to the press, and they're the team of called the Good Guys. I think that's under copyright, too. Isn't that Jim Shooter, the Good Guys, or something?
Isn't that a hamburger chip? No, that's 5 Guys. I don't know. Good guy. And so... They've kind of, Techno's not happy when they get away.
Yeah, he wanted to leave. He's like, come on.
And then suddenly a yellow minivan opens the door.
It's all he could find.
And who walks out?
Baron but Zemo. Our Zemo.
And a young body.
Yeah.
And for some reason he left the Iron Cross armor, but took some of it. I'm thinking maybe he wanted to take all that iron. Like, that seemed like a pretty good thing to have, you know?
I'm thinking this is what you wear maybe inside the Iron Cross armor.
He needed to fit in the car, guys.
Yeah.
Well, maybe he could just fly out in the Iron Cross. Like, who's going to stop him? Zemo's dead.
Yeah, I'd say, considering the cowl that he's holding and where the 2 bullet holes are.
So, yeah, it seems like Zemo's not for saving the world, and... Yeah, he might be up to conquering of his own. But we're not going to find out next issue, because apparently next issue is the Songbird Spotlight issue.
Oh.
And one of the other excellent features we have on our Thunderbolt segment is Kevin, contemporaneous when these issues came out, recorded some of his own thoughts. So we also get treated to 2002 Kevin's take, along with 2015 Kevin's take.
Well, 2015 Kevin really loved these issues. I guess it's good stuff.
I liked them too.
Yeah.
I thought the art team was, you know, goofing on that page aside, was super sharp. Like, you know, the storytelling's great. It's interesting plot twists. You know, a few little nitpicks here and there, but I'm really thumbs up. I would unreservedly recommend these. Steve?
Not enough Moonstone, not enough Songbird.
No,
that was all right. They were good.
So you made the right decision or not?
I don't know. Let's see where it goes. They're not back from this adventure yet. For all I remember, I might have been flipping through them on the stands and saying, nah.
still better than Redeemers, though, right?
Oh, yeah. That's what wore me down, guys.
It was supposed to make you feel good when the Thunderbolts come back, and then you're like, oh, this is the stuff. But anyways, 2002, Kevin. Thunderbolts number 60. He had a lot of love for the Fixer. He wonders if Zemo remembers everything about his time as Zemo, and if he will want to strike back and sink his teeth. That's his actual word, sink his teeth.
I love how you use the third person.
Of course. Into the V Battalion and cause some pain and trouble for them. You know, if he gets back to Earth. What if the Thunderbolts escape counter-Earth, but Zemo is left behind? Like, that's a whole world for Zemo to rule? And they're like, what rotten luck if that comes to pass for counter-Earth? Like, you had all that messed up world, the heroes left, there were still villains there, and then you get Doom, and then you get Zemo? Like, that's pretty bad. And then 2002, Kevin was all like, where's Melissa?
See?
Yeah. And he was like, will they form another Redeemers on Earth? You know, since the first one was such a big success with the massacre, he's kind of wondering if that's gonna take off again. I don't know if the CSA would, you know, want to do that again. For Thunderbolt 61, he's loving that the Thunderbolts are more or less together again. And it's more enjoyable than the Redeemers. Of course it is. You can't wait to see Hawkeye's face when Songbird tracks him down. It's such a tense atmosphere between Zemo and Fixer, because they, you know, they used to be friends and all that, and now it's just, I don't know if they could go back to being friends. That whole robot thing got between them. And he's surprised his name was in the hotel registry on the last page, with the other comicboards.com Thunderbolts fans. But he doesn't have to be jealous of those other people anymore. His name's in a comic, although he's not in his real name. Which is awkward.
Did you find that? Like, how did that, or did someone point it out to you? How did you discover it?
I probably looked there. You know, there's some kind of scribbling, and you turn around the page, and I was on the board too, so if someone probably posted there too, going, hey guys, check out the last page. I know Zercher was on the board around then too, so there was a lot of Marvel people still hanging around. The internet was growing up some, but forums were still big before social media. And for Thunderbolt 62, he's loving the art, the pacing, and the ever-changing status quo. This is getting kind of weird now. He's wondering if, can Carla still meet Phantom Eagle after the launch? You know, they were supposed to have a date or go on dinner or something. He's kind of wondering if that's still in her plans or if they can do anything about that.
I think she pulled the underwear up over his eyes and left him there, right?
Yeah. He says the Fixer always gets the best lines. More Fixer love. Are they going to use the name Thunderbolts on Counter-Earth? Like, they could use the Avengers, or I guess they could tarnish some other legacy or whatever they wanted to.
Tarnish some. They could help establish some other legacy.
Yeah. This is kind of weird because they're like, we're the good guys. We don't really, you know. And just how are they going to stop Zemo? They can't exactly put him in jail or cart his unconscious body all over Counter-Earth. I guess they should just kill him? Like, if they're staying on Counter-Earth, it's not like, what do you do with villains and all that? He's not happy with the 2-month wait for Counter-Earth. He's just like, ah, that's going to be a long wait. And since the story was so good this issue, he didn't really miss the whole chain gang thing. But some of these stories will sort of, in the future, sort of line up in a certain publishing pattern, so it'll be interesting. He's happy to see the Songbird focus next month. You know, big Moonstone Songbird fan. Same thing with you, little Steve, so.
Yep.
That's another Thunderbolts 2002 Kevin insightful.
He was in a comic.
Yeah. Hey,
I would totally interview 2002 Kevin. Find out what's going on.
He was still liking the Thunderbolts. I know what he thinks in a few issues, so I was kind of curious how he was feeling, how he was doing.
Like I said, I just love the third person. Because it's not really you, it's somebody totally unrelated. Well, until chronal time warp opens up and 2002 Kevin is face to face with 2015 Kevin. Keep hanging on for these heroes to return for our next Thunderbolt segment. Thanks for listening.
Later.